I'm very pleased to introduce to you Dr. Ransom Stevens. Dr. Stevens is a physicist, a science writer, a novelist. He's written hundreds of articles on a broad range of subjects, and he is here today to talk about one of his latest offerings, The Left Brain Speaks, The Right Brain Laughs. Dr. Stevens, welcome to Mind Talk.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Brewer. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, it truly is my pleasure. I expect to learn a great deal from you today.
Set the bar low. Appreciate that.
One of the things that you do, I mean, you draw on several different disciplines when you approach your writing. You draw upon your background in experimental particle physics, technology development, science, and fiction writing. And you create works that the layperson, in other words, pretty much anybody and everybody can understand. So as you begin your writing in The Left Brain Speaks, The Right Brain Laughs, you refer to neuroscience as a baby science that is just starting to reveal how brains work. Say a little bit more about that.
All right. Well, neuroscience really has just been a real science for about the last 15, 20 years. Before that, data was very difficult to come by because, you know, you can't really open up someone's brain and poke around and ask them questions and hope to figure out what this does and what that does. So it's a baby science in the sense that the experimental techniques are really not very strong yet. So compared to physics, which is my background, it's kind of like at the stage where physics was when Galileo first started goofing around with telescopes.
So pretty early, huh?
Yeah, pretty early. You know, it's before Newton did calculus. It's long, long before, you know, Ben Franklin was out flying kites and starting to see what electricity was. So it's a baby science, but we're all really fascinated in it because, you know, everybody wants to look under the hood and see how what makes us tick.
Well, speaking of what makes us tick, let's just start with the basics. Explain your title.
Oh, okay. Well, The Left Brain Speaks, The Right Brain Laughs is one of many titles that I listed for the publisher. My pet title was actually The Reality Interface, but that wasn't deemed appropriately marketable. So they asked for a list of possible titles, and this is the one they grabbed. And it's a little bit misleading because what it really should be is that the left brain tells the joke. The right brain gets the joke, but it is actually the left brain that does the har, har, har of laughing, at least for most of us.
Interesting. Now, you say, again, early on, that if your right brain was turned off, nobody would notice for a few hours. But if your left brain was turned off, people would think you were close to being an imbecile. So tell us, overall, what are the functions of the left and right brains?
Well, the reason for that is pretty simple. If your left brain's turned off, again, for most of us, if the left brain's turned off, you can't talk and you can't follow a train of thought in one direction. You can't sort of noodle along. But if your right brain's turned off, you can give the illusion, right? You would probably believe that you were just fine. You could talk, you could follow thoughts, but you would start showing delusions pretty quickly because, the left brain is the part of you that sees the needles within the pine forest, but the right brain sees the whole forest and the hills and the mountains and the valleys. So your left brain is the part that really does a great deal of imagination and fantasizes, but it's the right brain that reels you in and points out what's actually real and what's not. I like to use metaphors, you know, little silly stories to describe these things. And for this one, I like to use the story of Butch, the caveman, you know, about 50,000 years ago. He goes out and he's hunting. And we sort of, through the miracle of fiction, we fall in behind him and watch what he does. And what happens is he goes down and he gets a target, right? Say he's hunting a hippo. And he zeroes in on it and picks up a rock, and his left brain's deluded enough to think that he can, you know, kill a hippo with a rock and then manage to get it back to camp. But the right brain is the part that would alert him, you know, that thing's going to be pretty big. You probably can't get it back to camp without inventing the wheel and the cart. And let's face it, Butch, you're just not that good.
So clearly each side serves different but important purposes.
Yeah. Yeah. And just like our arms and legs and our eyes and our nostrils, you know, we have this symmetry, and part of it is a redundance. You know, if you lose one of your arms, it sets you at a disadvantage, but it's not nearly the disadvantage that if you only had one arm. So the left and right brains do play complementary roles, but they're also redundant, you know, so that if one of them does fail, then hopefully, eventually, you could train what's left over to function well enough for you to get along, so you'd never be, you know, you'd never be your whole self again.
Give us a sense of what might be some atypical ways in which a brain might function.
Well, you know, there's so many really sad ways. And I guess this starts to get into really your expertise. So I start to feel a little bit intimidated talking to someone with decades of experience in social psychology, but I'll give it a try.
Okay.
And the thing that comes to mind first is, schizophrenia, which is, you know, one of the most difficult and saddest illnesses that I think we can come up with, because any illness that tends to make you unpleasant to be with yet not show any signs of obvious sickness is sad, because right. You're not going to get the sympathy you need. It's very difficult to encourage people to help heal you when you're not very nice to them. So schizophrenia, for example, hearing voices goes back to this notion of having your right brain reel in the delusions of your left brain. We all hear voices. I mean, don't you talk to yourself? I talk to myself all the time. I even refer to me as you. You know, sometimes I even call myself by name. But within our own heads, We all hear different voices. I'll wager that you hear the voices of your parents periodically. But we're aware that those voices, you know, they're not real. They're not the solitary unit of I,
right,
the person that is me. And they aren't coming from outside my head. But when you get that imbalance, when you get an imbalance and you just can't tell whether they're real or not, and so they seem real. They seem like somebody outside your head talking to you. And you look, and are they there? Well, that's where the delusions can really get you going, and right. It becomes a really horrible, sad thing. I'm kind of amazed, you know, that these biological, these things we carry around in our heads and in our bellies and stuff, the chemical balance that keeps them running smoothly is really astounding. And the fact that there's so many of us, and as on scale, you know, the vast majority of us really do just fine.
It's true. But, you know, as you were talking about schizophrenia, you know, it's one of, you're right. I mean, I certainly agree with you that it's really a difficult experience. And you know, it's like you can't really get away from yourself, but you can't really let anybody else in either. So it really is a very, very painful, can be a very painful and certainly limiting experience for many people. But for the most part, for the perhaps broader majority of us, our left brain does what it does, our right brain does what it does. And you say that with the right brain, facial identification is one of the skills with mild racial bias, and that with the left brain, there is lesser facial identification, but without the built-in bigotry. Explain that a little bit more.
This is all results from the research that I did with multiple citations, and this is one that I did, you know, go in and confirm. And I think that the racial bias goes straight to the notion of our tribes, of, you know, who we are and who they are. Of course, that can be retrained. And there is compelling evidence for this minor racial bias, this sort of built-in initial notion of us and them, and that it follows by race. But it can be retrained. And the main thing to keep in mind with that, I think, is that we identify ourselves in different groups. And those different groups will tend to look upon others with less favor than they look upon our own. In fact, you can see it. You can see it in the way people respond and the way that they smile within their groups and externally. And let me give you an example. This example is very close to my heart. And it is, I'm a fan of the Oakland Raiders football team. And the Raider Nation is, I think, the most diverse group of people in the world, because it is truly 30% African-American, 30% Caucasian, 30% Hispanic, not all that well represented by the Asian population, but there are a few aliens among us too. And when we are together, we are truly, you know, this is us. And certainly, you know, within the confines of the Oakland Alameda County Coliseum, there is the other too. And this group of people, the Raider Nation, is not always kind to the other, but we certainly are nice to each among ourselves. So I look at this as an example of how we can truly redefine what it means to be us as opposed to them. And our trick, I think that a key trick to society is finding a way to identify all of us as us and none of us as them, so that we don't have these kind of immediate, very fast, visceral reactions to those people that we conceive of as the other.
You know, when you look at the fact of racial bias from the perspective that you just described, it seems to me that it would kind of take a tiny bit of the edge off as people really try to grapple with what this is, how it exists, and what we can do differently. But just like anything that worked when you were a child or that was thrust upon you when you were a child, you really can opt to do something different, which is another wonderful thing that the brain allows us to do. It's to make different decisions with different information, or even broader decisions with the same information.
That's right. Yeah, I agree. And one of the things to keep in mind is that our brains operate really on three separate time scales, okay? There's the time scale that of our most visceral reactions, things like starting to sweat, our heartbeats going up, our breathing, our respiration increasing. Those occur on a scale of about 300th of a second. About 7 times slower than that are our emotional reactions, including our immediate physical reactions, like things like hitting the brakes. You can't hit the brakes faster than 2/10 of a second after you see the brake lights in the car in front of you go on. So that's about 7 times slower than the respiration. And then there's thinking, that conscious thought, and that takes at least 0.5 seconds, usually more like 3/4 of a second, for us to become aware of anything. And so something like a bias, and I don't mean bigotry in particular, but any kind of prejudice, anything that we prejudge before we think about it, occurs at one of these other time scales. But we can change that. And the way we change it is simply by being aware of it and practicing. And this is why I think that, you know, prejudice, we can be aware of it, we can correct it. And so when we don't correct it, it's the ultimate form of laziness. It benefits no one, and it hurts us the most. I really think that the prejudiced person suffers by losing out on the whole world, by rejecting it out of hand. And we all have our prejudices. We're simply built that way. We need to be prejudiced against saber-toothed tigers in order to continue to exist. And it's cheap and fast to have prejudices and stereotypes, and takes more energy and takes more thought to think things through and recognize a nuance and then see what really is dangerous, what really isn't, and what really is wonderful in life and what really isn't.
Well, you certainly do make the point that there was a time in our early existence where, as you said, it made sense to be prejudice against a saber-toothed tiger. It made sense to identify people in terms of groups, good group, bad group, in-group, out-group. But that over time, as you've said, that needs to change. For some people it has, for some people it hasn't.
Well, only if we want to continue to survive on this big wet rock. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think it's the compelling problem of our species is that this is one of the things that we absolutely have to overcome if we're going to find a way to get along together.
Talk about, I'm quoting you, you say evolution predicts what already happened. And I thought about that for a second. I said, oh, okay, I get it. But explain it in your language.
Okay.
What do you mean by that?
All right. Well, this is what I mean. When you have a scientific theory, for example, in physics, you come up with a theory of how nature works, or for example, how a football flies. If you tell me the initial speed and direction of a football out of a quarterback's hands, I can tell you where it'll land with really tremendous accuracy. But evolution is not like that. Evolution, if I'm given all of the initial conditions, I'm told everything there is to know about a system of organs, you know, people or animals or bacteria in a petri dish, I still can't predict accurately exactly what's going to happen, okay? That makes it a very tricky kind of theory because evolution says that whatever does happen will adapt in such a way that it survives, that it's those that survive will be naturally selected to fit that environment better. But it's impossible to predict exactly how that will come out because there are so many possibilities for different things, different adaptations, different features that will benefit an organ in that environment. You see what I mean?
I do. So in fact, if you're looking at any life, any entity, any piece of information, if you're looking at it in a lazy way, you're kind of stuck. If you're not open and expansive, then you're just kind of stuck.
Yeah, that's right. That's a very good point because natural selection is one of the many things that we abstract. We're kind of abstraction machines. So the way you just put it, you know, there's natural selection in a very raw physical, biological sense. But then there also is sort of selection. And what I'm really talking about is emergence, the way that different features of systems emerge from different conditions. And the thing is, the way to really catch it is this, that the possibilities are endless, but the probabilities are not. The probabilities all have to add up to 100%, but the possibilities are just huge and huge. So there's a lot of tiny probability, you know, tiny possibilities with tiny probabilities, and it's very difficult to predict which one will occur. And you can see this with like beehives and cities and software programs and all kinds of things. My favorite really is swarming, like swarms of birds, swallows in particular, the way they form these beautiful shapes. And it's a really good example, a simple example of emergence. You can't predict what those shapes will be, but you can predict a whole bunch of possibilities. And probably the possibility with the highest probability will be the one that happens, but you can't be sure. And that's true for anything that emerges like a civilization.
Folks, we are talking to Dr. Ransom Stevens, who is the author of many things, but today we're focusing on The Left Brain Speaks, The Right Brain Laughs, a look at the neuroscience of innovation and creativity in art, science, and life. We'll be right back. Dr. Stevens, in our the beginning of our conversation, you talked about some of the titles that you had offered your publishers, and the one that you wanted, which was not terribly sexy, was the one that they didn't want, was one of the ones they didn't want, and it was The Reality Interface. So I bring that up because you say that one of the funny things about reality is that you can only get so close to it. Now, from my perspective, I take that in a psychological place. And I think about the people I work with and the difficulties with seeing themselves as who they are, or the fear of seeing themselves as who they are. Where do you take this when you say this?
Well, I naturally take it very quickly to the physical, because what I mean is this, and the reality interface is our senses. We've got five senses. There's touch and smell and taste and sight and hearing. And we could throw in something like balance. That we can balance is kind of amazing. So, but the point is that we take data in into our bodies, into our brains, through a very finite set, a very small set of different detectors. And each of those detectors is very limited. And let me give you an example. Sight, which is our key sense. This sight is really the sense that we use most immediately to evaluate our surroundings. And we're only able to see a tiny, tiny fraction of the electromagnetic spectrum. And within that, we only see three colors. So we see red, green, and blue, or red, yellow, and blue, whichever you want. I don't care. But so we see three different colors, and each one of us sees slightly different, you know, a slightly different frequency range of that electromagnetic radiation. But it's a tiny fraction. And cats see more into the infrared, right? And dogs will see more into the UV, and different animals, though we all have very similar detectors, see different parts of reality. And so in that sense, we start out with a limit to how close we can get to reality, just because we're very limited in the parts of reality that we can detect. But it gets bigger than that, because everything that we're built from comes from these five senses, and not just our own, but our genome comes from, ultimately, the natural selection built around our ancestors' response to their five senses. So everything we are is built up from our experience of the world through these five limited senses. And because of that, we really can't get close to absolute reality, if such a thing can even be defined. Now, it becomes difficult to define because we can't get that close to it. So that becomes a philosophical question. But more practically, there's just a separation between the reality that we interact with, which is really our model of the universe inside our brains, and the actual universe that's out there. And that starts to get us on the path to what you're saying about a psychological sense of how close we can get to reality of who we really are and who others really are and how our responses are interpreted by others and all of that. That abstracted layer on top of this physical one.
You know, it occurs to me that, and I know it's not a new thought, but it just sort of dropped in at this moment. But the more that we could, just as a people, recognize that five different people can look at the exact same thing and have five different views, and it doesn't make any one view right or wrong, that really could, I would suggest, go a long way to creating a very different planet than the one we're occupying right now.
No question about it. Yeah, there's, I think that one of the key pieces, one of the things that I learned, and I learned a lot writing The Left Brain Speaks, The Right Brain Laughs, but one of the things that really is nailed home is the notion that we really, really, if we want to be better people, and I mean better in a very selfish sense as well as in a very altruistic sense, a generous sense, if we want to be better, the first thing to do is to hold fewer strongly held opinions. I feel very strongly that we should hold fewer strongly held opinions because they get in our way. Every time that we have a strongly held opinion, it means that we are building a wall between ourselves and possibilities. It's not just assuming that we're right, but we're programming how we think at every time scale. You know, immediately, bang, we'll throw out ideas before we even let them into consciousness. And when we do that, we're limiting our own universes. We're making it smaller. We're making our models of the world smaller, and that makes ourselves smaller.
And also the people that we interact with, it's sort of making their world experience smaller. Even if they disagree with us, we've given them our conceivably relatively small view.
Right. It's not very nice. There's that too. Yeah.
So you got a magic pill to fix all this stuff?
That's above my pay grade.
Okay. I just thought I'd ask.
Well, there is some wisecracking, you know, in the left brain speaks, the right brain laughs about, hey, man, this book costs less than $20. How much do you want?
So I guess that's a reminder to me, don't ask the big giant questions.
No, definitely ask them. They're the most fun. They're definitely the most fun. But yeah, temper your enthusiasm for the answer.
I gotcha. Fair enough. The way in which we experience the world around us and come up with our own perceptions, which we then make our own realities, which we then act on. What is the impact of that when we are minus one of the major senses?
Well, isn't that interesting? Yeah, either minus, or what if we have some extra? What if for whatever reason, some mutation, we can detect something that the others can't? Yeah, so altered perspective, this is one of the keys to creativity and innovation. And that, you know, from a selfish perspective, as I wrote this book, that's really what I was after. I wanted to understand how the brain works so that I could get more out of mine. You know, it's not a user's manual, but if there was one, I'd sure want to read it to see how I could get better. And this notion of what it takes to be creative is key. And that point really hits it.
When there is an absence of senses, let's say the experience of sight, is it true that the other senses then become heightened? And if it is true, why is that?
Absolutely. Yeah. It absolutely is true. I have no doubt of that. And so here's the reason. The senses, the way we process them at the various levels of our brain, is really cool. And it goes like this. There's this theory of neural Darwinism or neural pruning. And here's the idea. And this is not a confirmed scientific theory, but there's a big pile of evidence. So it's not, you know, there's compelling evidence, but it's not confirmed. And here's the idea, though, is that when we're born and around 2 years old, our brains just start throwing out connections. Or before two, as infants, our brains just start throwing out neurons to connect with different parts of the senses. And they do it randomly. They just throw them out. And so that there's this thing called synesthesia, where we misinterpret one sense for another. It's crosstalk. So you might, for example, taste a word, taste a sound, or associate a color with a sound, or associate a smell with something you see even before you've encountered it. And so all of the incorrect connections end up being pruned away. So for example, picture yourself as a baby and you're goo-goo and gaga-ing, right, in your bassinet and reaching out, and you see this little spoon of really horrible minced carrots coming your way, and you reach out for it expecting to see it closer. It won't work, right? You don't have sight detectors in your little hand, so you reach out and you can't see it closer. You can't magnify it by reaching for it. And so eventually that synapse, those connections, will be pruned away. So what happens is when one of the senses is depleted for whatever reason, then those connections that are built around it, all of the pattern detection software wetware that we have in our brains, is pruned away and we lose it. But it's not completely pruned away in the sense that that part of your brain can still be active. It's just not active for that sense. And so your sense of hearing starts to take some of that processing power. Your sense of hearing, all of the other senses grab hold and make use of your brain, because anything that's not being used in there will tend to be used for some other purpose. So yeah, when you lose a sense, you get better at the other. So this is an example of plasticity, the ability of the brain to dynamically adapt to situations as they occur. But it takes time. And here's a way to think about the time that it takes. Think of a plant that grows really fast. I always think of morning glories because, you know, they're beautiful, and boy, do they grow fast. It's the sort of thing where you can grow connections in your brain, and they grow at about the same speed as a fast-growing plant. So you can't throw it out in an instant. You can configure patterns in your brain consciously very quickly, but you can't actually grow sort of permanent networks to recognize things, to build up one sense in favor of others. Except at about a 20-minute time scale. That's how long, roughly, very roughly, it takes to notice a change in morning glory vine growing. If you look at it now and it's a sunny day, you wait 20 minutes and you go out and look at it again, you'll see a little change. And that's about the time scale that we grow physical connections, neurons, and axons in our brains. So if we keep practicing, and you do, if you're blind, you're going to keep practicing hearing things because that's your new interface. If we keep practicing, then these connections grow stronger and stronger and stronger. And we develop parts of our brain dynamically over the course of hours, days, weeks, months. And then we start to maximize what we can get out of the senses that remain. And this goes up to higher layers too. My favorite example of this is music. But another one that's easier is reading, right? We learn how to read, but as we learn how to read, if you remember, at first we're sounding out words and building sentences. But when you're learning to read, you sound out the words of a sentence, and by the time you get to the end of the sentence, you've forgotten what the words were in that sentence. You have to go back and remember and reread them. But now you just sounded them out so you can remember what they were and figure out what the sentence is. But when you get good at it, once you make that switch, once you learn how to read, then you can crank through paragraphs and chapters, right, without even really paying attention to the letters. You're just cruising right through. It's the same sort of thing with developing one sense when another's been lost. That at first it's very difficult, but then the physical connections start to be built up, and at some point you make a transition and you become good at it. Playing the guitar is the same way. You're staring at your fingers on the frets trying to make a chord, and then you strum it and you recognize what the sound is. It's a long way from just playing a song.
The idea that the brain could actually change, that you could be an adult and experience changes in your brain such that you actually can begin to change the way you think in the world is really kind of amazing. And I would suggest that concept really kind of set all of us on one ear as we began to really think about the fact that the brain really could change over time. Can you just say a little bit more about neuroplasticity?
Okay. So here's the thing, and you can do this. Anyone can do this. It's really, here's a really simple sounding, but extraordinarily difficult and challenging way to go about demonstrating for yourself that you can make big changes in the way your brain works. That is, switch careers. There you go. Just make a big switch in your career. Do something crazy like, go from being a research physicist to being a novelist. It's a very difficult transition.
Crazy thing to do. It's a crazy thing
absolutely.
To do.
I don't advise it at all. It's a very, very bad move. But even so, it's a trip. And you'll start to see very, very significant changes in your behavior, especially if you keep a journal. And it's, as a side note, this is something I've been doing for about 10 years now, is every day I write one line. You know, if you say you're going to keep a diary, it starts to beat you down because you feel compelled to write something significant every day. But if you limit it to one line every day, just one line, no more, no less, of something you remember from the day before, then it's really easy. It takes no time, and you can build up an image of who you were years and years before. But that's aside from the point. Plasticity. So when we start something new, and again, I want to go back to music because it's such a great example. When you start to play an instrument, the area in your brain around where you process sounds literally starts to grow. And it will grow, it can grow 20, 30% larger as you practice, as you are learning how to play this instrument. And then, just like with babies who are learning how to experience the world, once you start to learn how to play the instrument, once you make that transition from, for a guitar, looking at your fingers on the frets and strumming and trying to remember what note's coming and what the lyrics are, once you make the transition from playing a song, from that to playing a song, from staring and being so careful with your fingers to just making music, then that 20 to 30% larger part of your brain starts to snip away. It gets smaller again. It removes all those connections that don't help. It just leaves the connections that work. So you throw things out. Nature just tries stuff. And the stuff that works, it keeps. And the stuff that doesn't work, it cuts away. Because nature, well, nature is like, it's like a consultant, right? You can have it good, fast, or cheap. Pick two. And nature always goes with fast and cheap, where cheap means efficient and fast means something that will get you out of trouble in a hurry.
You know, the idea that the brain could actually change, you know, I think for so many years we just didn't think about the brain could actually change in the way that we're aware of it now. But as you think about the rest of your life and the rest of your world and the rest of your body, it's all changing all the time. So why wouldn't the brain be a part of that, since the brain actually creates all of that?
Yeah, and the good news is that while you age and the whole lot of your body is really just decaying, it's not very much fun, a lot of it, your brain can actually get better and learn more things. And yeah, it goes back to some of those silly things we were told as kids, you know, that you only use 10% of your brain. But it's not true at all. You use your whole brain all the time. It's just up to you as to how well you use it, how well you try and focus things, and in some ways try to fight back against some of the things that come naturally that are really lazy.
Folks, we are speaking with Ransom Stevens, the author of Left Brain Speaks, Right Brain Laughs. We're going to take a break, but we'll be back in just a moment, so you stay where you are. Dr. Stevens, you say that we as human beings pretty much share the same emotional processing equipment as animals do. And I would suggest that there are probably some folks who just heard me say that and say, oh, she's wrong. He never said that.
I did, though. And the reason is that, well, we do. There's among the mammals anyway, not really true for the reptiles, and partly true, amazingly true for the birds, though in a much more not as well as understood. The birds turn out to be really, really clever creatures who are really on top of things. So that business about bird brains turned out to be wrong. The size of the brain really is not that great a predictor of how powerful that brain is. But yeah, the thing is, we can look at our brain as three different segments. The reptilian part, which I call your inner frog, and the emotional part, which I call your inner puppy, and the outside, the intellectual, the part that's really conscious of things that we do our planning with, which I call your inner Richard Feynman, because Richard Feynman was the great American physicist of the 20th century. And so that outside part of your brain, the crinkly gray part, is the part that we do our quantum physics with, for example. But what we share with the other animals is all in our inner puppy. And it includes obvious things like memories, but it also includes the formation of memories, which obviously all of the mammals need to do to survive. We have to have some memories. But it also includes our 4F center, the fight, flight, freeze, or mate, and all of the parts of our brain that process emotions. And since we share all of these components, we have the same components in our brain, though different sizes and different connections, but we have the same essential equipment as all of the other mammals. And so to say that we experience emotions and they don't just seems, well, it violates anything related to common sense. If we've got the same equipment, then we probably do the same stuff with it. In fact, we must. So yeah, this is one of the really cool things that comes out of neuroscience, is physical, hardcore evidence that animals are very much emotional creatures. So your dog is really feeling a lot. In fact, I might argue, in fact, I'm going to argue right now, that since your dog or cat, well, less so with cats, I suppose, dogs, since they lack that outer layer, that intellectual outer layer, they don't have as much of that, they're really more captive to their emotions, their feelings, than people are. We have the ability to be rational and cold, and they don't. They're emotionally driven. So when you look at that dog and you think it loves you, you're right. It does.
Interesting. You know, I think about all of the quote-unquote wonderful advances that we have in the world today. We've got computers that can essentially think for us. They can certainly give us answers a lot more quickly than we could come upon them ourselves. We've got cars that are more and more driving for themselves. Is all of this automation, all of these advances, are these helpful to the functioning of the brain, or do they teach us to be more lazy?
Yeah, that's right. Both are certainly true. So what we tend to do, and this is a very general statement that goes back to picking up a rock and throwing it, is that we extend our bodies by making tools. And this is something that is not completely unique to people, but for the most part, we're the only species around that really builds stuff. We aren't the only species that uses tools. Birds, you know, will throw nuts down to the ground to break them open. Other animals build stuff. Ants build nests and so forth. But for the most part, yeah, we extend our universe by building stuff. And for example, the X-ray, right? We can't see X-rays, so we build equipment so that we'll see X-rays for us. And then a car, well, we need to get around, so we build something that is better than our feet at getting around. And then a driverless car, well, that's even better because now I can read a book when I'm sitting in there, provided I trust the software. And let me tell you, I don't. But eventually I will. You just have to convince me. And memory, right? Our children, at least, I guess my kid's kid, if she has one, you know, they're so, millennials, this is the example of the millennial, is that they don't need to remember stuff because they know they can Google it, right? So we build a bigger brain, and this isn't new. It is just getting faster and bigger all the time. One of the amazing things that's completely obvious, but still amazing, is that as human beings, you know, we're really good at not having to reinvent the wheel. We go to school, and in 12 years of education, from kindergarten to 12th grade, we essentially learn all of the knowledge that has been acquired by human beings from the dawn of time until a couple of decades ago, like 15, 20,000 years of civilization and 12 years of education, approximately. It's kind of amazing. But we keep building on that and abstracting things, and at some point, we will have, it will be common for people to have brain implants that will store memories, that will store knowledge, that will probably even store skills, kind of like in the Matrix, where you plug something in and then know a martial art. The thing about these, right, so this is all really nice, but, well, maybe, depending on your feeling, I'm sometimes just glad I'm going to be dead in 50 years and won't have to face all this technology. But so it sounds like it can be very positive, and like any technology, it can, but it isn't necessarily positive, because what do we do when it's not there? How do you get around if your car's not operating? Well, you walk, but you can't walk that far, right? So the same thing will be true with our brains, is that if we extend our brains more and more with technology, then we always run the risk that if that technology fails or is somehow compromised, maybe by hacking, I don't know, lots of things come to mind about how our collective brain might be hacked or altered without our permission, then it can certainly play against us in very intimidating and scary ways. So it's right. It is a very double-edged sword how we use our brains to build things to help us that can at the same time destroy us. And if you look at the progress of civilization and compare it to the rate at which we devour the resources of this planet, there's a very strong correlation that our progress is directly tied to our ability to annihilate ourselves. So, yes, it's the sharpest of double-edged swords.
And as you put it in those terms, it really does cause one to at least take a breath and really think about that.
I hope so.
Absolutely.
But I'm not sure it's true, right? I think most of us, I don't know, it's hard to speak of most of us. It's easy for me to take the impression that a lot of people just kind of go about their lives without reflecting on the tools they use. But then I don't know a single person myself who I talk to who doesn't consider these things. So then I think, nah, I'm probably wrong. People are more complicated than we think. And that's one of those strongly held opinions that I have to quash down consciously until I'm trained not to do it. I do it unconsciously.
You talk about ways to cultivate a resilience to failure. We clearly are living in a time where for many, many people, you either succeed or you fail. There's nothing in between. And therefore, you're either good or bad. You're either worthwhile or not worthwhile. How do you, aside from the fact that just from my perspective, that's not all that healthy, how does one in this environment in particular cultivate a resilience to failure?
Well, the first way is when you meet a challenge is to recall all the times that you have conquered challenges. And we all have, right? Everybody's got problems. Everybody faces challenges at work and at home and every area of their lives. But we've always encountered challenges. And those challenges come, you know, on the billing scale of 30 days. How am I going to pay this bill? To the big ones, how am I going to deal with this illness? Or the really cool abstract ones, how am I going to solve this huge problem for this organization that I work with, that I believe in? And the way to cultivate the resistance to failures first, when you feel that sort of stress, that injection of stress that feels sort of like panic and can feel very much like panic, is to think back to other challenges that you have conquered, but also challenges that you have failed to conquer. Because failure in reality is almost never as bad as it seems like it's going to be when you're pondering it. Because, well, if you're still here, you managed to get through it one way or another. And, you know, it's certainly not universally true, but we all have cases where we've faced challenges, succeeded, and failed. And to ground yourself and be resilient to failure so that you can approach the problem and be successful, but just helps to remind yourself you've been here before, you're going to be here again, grind it out. But there's more. And here's another thought. I do a lot of work in Silicon Valley, and there's this mantra there in the Valley in the development of new technologies, which is to fail fast. A lot of companies, a lot of high-tech companies really encourage their employees to fail as quickly as possible. Because if you try something and it's not going to work, the sooner we find out that it won't work, the better off we're going to be. So there's this culture of risk-taking to encounter, to try something and find out if it'll work as fast as possible. Of course, the way to do that is to make it so that failure doesn't hurt you, that it only hurts this system, that maybe it takes time. Maybe it feels like you wasted time because what you were trying didn't work. But in reality, it's very rarely truly wasted time, because what you learn by trying something that doesn't work, you carry everywhere you go forever after. When I was a professor, and I would have students come in and say that they had studied and studied and studied, you know, really put in the hours, and I knew that they had because I see their work. And then say, but, you know, man, I only got a C. I worked so hard, and I only got a C. It just seems like such a waste. And every time I would tell them that every hour of work you do will eventually pay off. You just don't know when. So this concept of failure, I agree, it's something we have to deal with and not make it a stigma, because everybody fails. And everybody succeeds. And there really isn't that big a difference between the two, objectively. But subjectively, boy, there sure is a gap, isn't there?
Absolutely. And as you describe failure from the perspective of, let's hurry up and do it quickly so we can move on, it sounds like failure is really a stepping stone. So it's not a brick or a stone you dive under and stay. It is one step towards the next step, towards really getting where and what you want.
That's right. That's right. And that's why it is this mantra in technology development, that if you are held to a standard where you must succeed, then you will never take risks. You will never try things that might not work. And the great innovations, you know, in Silicon Valley, what they call the disruptive technologies, disruptive because they alter the field, those things would never come about at all. There would be no World Wide Web if Christopher Berners-Lee hadn't had this idea and taken the time to try it. You know, and I was there. I was working on an experiment at CERN when he was developing the World Wide Web. And, you know, he was trying all kinds of different things, and very few of them worked. Only one of them needed to. And boy, did it.
Absolutely. You, as I'm looking at your points in terms of unlocking your innate creativity, one of the points that you make, one of the recommendations, is that you must silence your tendency to predict results. It sounds like you're saying don't make your world smaller than it needs to be before it is. But you tell me, what are you saying?
No, this goes straight back to what we started with, talking about prejudice.
Okay.
That's it. This is prejudice in the largest sense. Certainly, bigotry is its ugliest form, but its most insidious form, the most insidious form of prejudice, is to reject ideas before you entertain them. And that is what I call idea prejudice. In order to innovate, to be creative, you really have to open up to all the ideas that your brain supplies you. And if we quiet our brains, you will be amazed at the ideas that surface. The trick is not to let everything you've learned in the past get in the way of what you can learn in the future, because whatever you face next is all new.
Dr. Ransom Stevens, who is the author of many publications. Today we've been discussing The Left Brain Speaks, The Right Brain Laughs. Dr. Ransom, is there a website? Is there a place where folks can go to continue to look at the kinds of things you're doing?
Yeah, sure. My website, my writerly website is ransomstevens.com, and you spell my name Ransom, like kidnapping note, R-A-N-S-O-M, and Stevens with a P-H, S-E-E-P-H-E-N-S. And as far as The Left Brain Speaks, The Right Brain Laughs go, you know, it's not a self-help book, but it is a book, hopefully, where if you get a look under the hood and an idea of how your brain works, then we can be better, that we can understand how our brains work, we can just put it to work better, and we can solve some of these big problems that we face individually and together. And that's my highest hope in writing that book.
You answered my next question, so thank you for that. And thank you for joining us today on Mind Talk.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Brewer. This has really been something. You really pull it out of me. I appreciate that. Thank you.
I appreciate your availability. Folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service and is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications, and it is available to you on demand at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can also download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes Store or from Google Play. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, you can always send an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at Mind Talk. And again, that's mindtalk .org. And folks, one final reminder, if it's unacceptable, then it is in fact absolutely unacceptable.